Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Today you can hear Jill Bevilacqua's reflections for this Palm Sunday entitled There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Then, as Pope Benedict presides at the handing over of the World Youth Day cross and icon from the organisers of Sydney 2008 to the Madrid team for 2011, we hear some very personal testimony for those closely involved in the organisation of the Australian event. We begin today's programme then with the Gospel for this Palm Sunday, read to us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The soldiers led Jesus out to crucify him. A man named Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was coming in from the fields, and they pressed him into service to carry the cross. When they brought Jesus to the site of Golgotha, which means skull place, they tried to give him wine drugged with myrrh, but he would not take it. Then they crucified him and divided up his garments by rolling dice for them to see what each should take. It was about 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The inscription proclaiming his offense read, "The King of the Jews." With him they crucified 2 insurgents, one at his right and one at his left. People going by kept insulting him, tossing their heads and saying, "Ha, so you were going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days? Save yourself now by coming down from that cross." The chief priests and the scribes also joined in and jeered. "He saved others, but he cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down from that cross here and now, so that we can see it and believe in him." The men who had been crucified with him likewise kept taunting him. When noon came, darkness fell on the whole countryside and lasted until mid-afternoon. At that time Jesus cried in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" A few of the bystanders who heard it remarked, "Listen, he's calling on Elijah." Someone ran off and, soaking a sponge in sour wine, stuck it on a reed to try to make him drink. The man said, "Now let's see whether Elijah comes to take him down." Then Jesus, uttering a loud cry, breathed his last. At that moment the curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two from top to bottom. The centurion who stood guard over him on seeing the manner of his death declared, "Clearly, this man was the Son of God."
The extract from St. Mark's account of the Passion of our Lord is taken from the final part of the short form of this Gospel, corresponding to what we know as the Way of the Cross. "They led him out to crucify him," we read in the Jerusalem Bible version. Out, that is, from the praetorium, where Jesus had been tried and condemned to death, and out of the city, to crucifixion. Jewish custom, strictly adhered to in our Lord's time, kept totally separated the activities of life and those connected with death, execution and burial, so that both Calvary and the tomb where our Lord was laid were outside the walls of Jerusalem, not far from the northwestern section of the city wall of those days. Today, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which houses both these sacred sites, is in the centre of the Christian quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. For all those Christians like ourselves who do not live in Jerusalem, the Way of the Cross, or the Stations as they're called, is the name given to a devotional exercise and the series of images representing successive incidents in the Passion of our Lord, from the time he leaves the judgment hall to the moment of his burial. The 14 stations, today a 15th is often added, depicting the resurrection, are usually in a church, on the walls at each side. But in some places, as at Lourdes, they're in the open air. The practice of doing the stations is particularly common in Lent, and on Good Friday here in Rome, the Pope himself leads the Way of the Cross in a live version at the Colosseum, with meditations often by well-known writers. But for those who live in the Holy City, no church is needed, for they possess the original Via Dolorosa, the sorrowful road, which Jesus took, bearing his cross on his back, through the streets of Jerusalem and out up to the hill of Calvary. Writes today's guidebook.
Following the Roman custom of the times, those who were condemned to death were obliged to walk through the city with their name and details of their conviction displayed.
H.V. Morton, in his book In the Steps of the Master, comments.
Those who thronged the streets near the Praetorium would have seen the terrible but familiar procession of death. A centurion in charge of a half-maniple of the 12th Legion came first, riding on horseback and clearing a path through the narrow streets. Behind him walked a legionary, bearing a notice board on a pole. Written in red on a background of white gypsum was a brief account of the crimes committed by those about to die.
And returning to the guidebook, we read.
The Via Dolorosa is a street no different from any other street in the northern part of the old city, except for the 9 stations which lie along it to commemorate the dramatic events of Jesus' last journey. 5 stations are inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The exact route of the Via Dolorosa, as well as the location of the stations along it, is still disputed by scholars. The Way of the Cross, as it is today, was not finally fixed until the 15th century. Every Friday at 3 p.m., the Franciscans hold a procession along the Via Dolorosa.
It's a journey, it might seem, as one writer puts it, mercifully short, scarcely 1,000 paces. But for the man who had been brutally scourged and crowned with thorns, and was now struggling under the weight of the great crossbeam, it must have seemed more like 1,000 miles. And in fact, he has not gone far when he falls, and even when he staggers to his feet, it's clear that he cannot go on alone. And so when they see a man coming in from the fields, who seems strong and active, the soldiers seize on him. Writes Morton.
Worn out with suffering and emotion, our Lord was unable to keep pace with the procession, and it seems that in the pressing into service of Simon the Cyrenian, we may detect a touch of kindness on the part of the centurion, Longinus, who was soon to testify to the divinity of his prisoner and to embrace the Christian faith.
Cardinal Newman, in his Meditations on the Stations, suggests that it was Mary who, by her prayers, sent Simon the Stranger to help. And who was he? Father of Alexander and Rufus, writes Mark, as if that explained everything. The scholars tell us that Simon was a repatriate Jew from Cyrene, which was an important Libyan port, a city where there was a fairly large community of Jews. As for his sons, we only have suppositions. In the Valley of Cedron, an inscription on a bone urn discovered in 1941 mentions a certain Alexander, son of Simon, who could be the same one mentioned by Mark. It's not certain, however, whether the Rufus mentioned in Paul's letter to the Romans is the same one. Paul greets Rufus, a chosen servant of the Lord, and his mother, who, says Paul, has been a mother to me too. What a lot of mysteries are still unsolved. And now let's listen to a modern meditation on the 5th station of the cross by Abbé Michel Quast.
He passed by on the road. They pressed him into service, the first to come along, a stranger. Lord, you accepted his help. You did not want the help of a friend, the solace of a gesture of love, the generous impulse of one who cared. You chose the enforced help of an indifferent and timid fellow. Lord all-powerful, you sought the help of a powerless man. By your own choosing, you are in need of us. Lord, I need others. The way of man is too hard to be trodden alone. But I avoid the hands outstretched to help me. I want to act alone. I want to fight alone. I want to succeed alone. And yet beside me walks a friend, a spouse, a brother, a neighbor, a fellow worker. You have placed them near me, Lord, and too often I ignore them. And yet it is together that we shall save the world. Lord, even if they are requisitioned, grant that I may see, that I may accept all the Simons on my road.
And so the sad procession went on. Behind Jesus followed the 2 thieves, or malefactors, carrying their crossbeams. And behind again, marching 6 to the rank, the remainder of the maniple, or subdivision of the legion, shouldering their spears. As the group passed through the Gate Gennath, or Gate of Judgment, they would have seen their final destination. Meanwhile, as H. V. Morton writes,
"In the sunlight of a spring morning, when the swifts were flying above the walls of Jerusalem, as they do to this day in the month of Nisan, three crosses were set up outside the city gate. A few yards from the city wall, beside the main road into Jerusalem from the north, stood a place called Golgotha, the place of a skull. There's nothing in any of the four Gospels to suggest that Golgotha was a hill, but it's been assumed that it must have been so. The first person to call it a hill was the Bordeaux pilgrim who visited Jerusalem in 333 AD, when the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was being built. He mentioned the little hill of Golgotha, where the Lord was crucified."
Our Lord spoke in Aramaic, and the word Golgotha is a Greek transliteration of the Aramaic Gulgoleth. The Latin equivalent was Calvaria, an obsolete word for skull, hence our word Calvary. Legend has it that the skull of Adam was preserved here, but the name is believed more to have come from a fancied resemblance of the ground to a skull. As the guidebook comments, Golgotha being today inside a building, it's very difficult to imagine the original configuration of the site, which was a sinister place outside the city. H. V. Morton too found it hard to imagine what it had been like.
"This was the hill of the crucifixion, Calvary, the holiest place on earth. I looked around, hoping to be able to detect some sign of its former aspect, but that has been obliterated forever beneath the suffocating trappings of piety. The chapel before which I was kneeling was the chapel of the raising of the cross. The chapel next to it was the chapel of the nailing to the cross. When the crowd thinned, I approached nearer to the altar. A Greek priest was there, beckoning me to come near the altar. He pointed out a silver disc edged with candle grease, and below it a hole in the rock, in which he whispered to me, the cross of our Lord was fixed. The pilgrims came up, weeping and praying, to touch the rock with trembling fingers, and I went away, wishing that we might have known this place only in our hearts."
On arrival at Golgotha, the soldiers, we read, tried to give Jesus wine drugged with myrrh, but he would not take it. Writes Morton,
"In Jerusalem, a society of charitable women provided a merciful drug for those about to be crucified. It was administered just before the victim, stretched on the ground, was nailed to the crossbeam. The inspiration for this act of compassion was the ordinance in Proverbs, 'Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish.' It's believed that the potion offered by these women was a mixture of wine and drugs, including frankincense, laudanum, myrrh, resin, saffron, and mastic."
"Then they crucified him," states Mark boldly. But we need words and images to help us understand the mystery of our redemption. And so let's hear how Newman reflected on the 11th station, Jesus is nailed to the cross.
"The cross is laid on the ground, and Jesus stretched upon it. And then, swaying heavily to and fro, it is, after much exertion, jerked into the hole, ready to receive it. Or, as others think, it is set upright, and Jesus is raised up and fastened to it. As the savage executioners drive in the huge nails, he offers himself to the Eternal Father as a ransom for the world. The blows are struck, the blood gushes forth. Yes, they set up the cross on high, and they placed a ladder against it, and having stripped him of his garments, made him mount. With his hands feebly grasping its sides and crosswoods, and his feet slowly, uncertainly, with much effort, with many slips, mounting up, the soldiers propped him on each side, or he would have fallen. When he reached the projection, where his sacred feet were to be, he turned around, with sweet modesty and gentleness, towards the fierce rabble, stretching out his arms as if he would embrace them. Then he lovingly placed the backs of his hands close against the transverse beam, waiting for the executioners to come with their sharp nails and heavy hammers to dig into the palms of his hands and to fasten them securely to the wood. There he hung, a perplexity to the multitude, a terror to evil spirits, the wonder, the awe, yet the joy, the adoration of the holy angels. And the hours wore on. The soldiers beneath the cross shook dice in a helmet for the seamless coat. They lay down on Golgotha in the heat of the day to eat bread and cheese and to drink their sour wine.
And what of the chief priests and the scribes? They were there all right, mocking, jeering. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down from that cross here and now so that we can see it and believe in him. But as Frank Sheed writes,
none of this meant a great deal to the priest on the cross, concentrating his mind on the Father, to whom, and on the race of man for whom, he was suffering the redemptive sacrifice. His mockers had no more claim on his attention than any other of the myriads whose sins he was dying that he might expiate. He heard them, of course, but they were on the periphery only. Even the measureless agony of his nailed body was peripheral. The centre was drawing his whole being to itself. His enemies did not expect him to answer them, nor did he, precisely. But suddenly they heard a great voice crying out, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?"
This antiphon to today's responsorial psalm is the opening to Psalm 22, which these learned men would have known well. So much was in it of what they were now seeing, writes Sheed.
I am a worm and no man, the butt of men, laughingstock of the people.
And they would see themselves in that same psalm.
All who see me deride me. They curl their lips, they toss their heads. These people stare at me and gloat.
But the psalm, which opens in desolation, ends in triumph.
Men will proclaim the Lord to generations still to come, his righteousness to a people yet unborn.
While remembering this ending, Sheed concludes,
they must have felt the chill of uncertainty. Would he, after all, thrust their taunts down their throats by a last-minute descent from the cross?
They could not know that God's design was a very different one. It was for those later generations to discover, as the writer in George Herbert's poem Redemption must do. Here it is.
Having been tenant long to a rich lord, not thriving, I resolved to be bold and make a suit unto him to afford a new small rented lease and cancel the old. In heaven at his manor I him sought. They told me there that he was lately gone about some land which he had dearly bought long since on earth to take possession. I straight returned, and knowing his great birth, sought him accordingly in great resorts, in cities, theatres, gardens, parks, and courts. At length I heard a ragged noise and mirth of thieves and murderers. There I him espied, who straight, "Your suit is granted," said, and died.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented "There's More in the Sunday Gospel than Meets the Eye." This Palm Sunday also marks the Diocesan World Youth Day, celebrated by local churches around the world. And during the course of Mass for our Lord's Passion, which Pope Benedict celebrates in St. Peter's Square, the giant World Youth Day cross and icon are handed over from the organisers of Sydney 2008 to the Madrid team, who will be hosting the next international event in Spain in 2011. For all those who were involved in the organisation of the last World Youth Day celebrations, it's a powerful and poignant moment as they pass on the baton for what, over almost a quarter of a century, has become one of the most important events for young Catholics today.
Yeah, you're right. It will be very powerful on Sunday.
Australian Annalise Wursthorn is currently studying in Rome at the Emmanuel School of Mission. But last year, she spent 6 months travelling around Australia with the World Youth Day cross and icon ahead of the July celebrations in Sydney.
I began volunteering in January 2008 and accompanied the cross as it journeyed around Australia. The cross actually went around Australia for 12 months, and I was with it for six of the 12 months.
So where did you go?
My team, we travelled throughout some of the dioceses in New South Wales and Canberra, Victoria, Tasmania and Western Australia.
So what are your lasting memories of that, perhaps? The things that struck you most? I'm sure every place you went, yeah, you had a very different reception and lots of very important moments. But if you had to pick out, for example, steps along the journey that really had a lasting impact on you.
Yes, as you say, there were so many memories, and I've just been thinking back and different memories come to mind, and it's really amazing to just get myself back in the moment. In particular, I was really struck. We had a big youth festival in Wollongong. It was called the Light of the Cross Festival, and it was just fantastic. There were 4,000 young people there, and it was just beautiful. They got all the young people involved, and the cross was centre stage. It was really centre stage. It was really the main event. So that was one of them. I definitely would have to mention visiting the Aboriginal communities in the Broome Diocese, which was very powerful. In particular, one of the communities that we visited, it had just being mourning the death of a young person, and the cross, we took the cross down to the Surrey camp, and all the family members came forward to venerate the cross, and it was very special. And the priest from that community said that he was so surprised because everyone, he said he saw everyone in the community come to that event. So there were hundreds of people coming to that event. But there were also many, many joyful times. The cross went on boats. It went, we walked through the main street of pretty much every town we went to. We went to many schools. There's so many different things. Yeah, it's really hard to...
In terms of practical transport, it's a big cross, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the logistics of this.
Sure. So it's 3.8 metres long and 1.75 metres wide. And it actually, we in Australia, we had a special trailer built for it, and it comes in a case as well. Yeah, so we loaded that cross in and out of the case several times a day. We got quite good at it. It's held together by four bolts. And to transport it, we take it in half, so it's able to be moved a bit easier. But it's very heavy, and it requires at least three or four people to carry it.
We're talking about 2008. The cross, of course, has a long history, doesn't it? Tell us a bit about the beginnings of it. It was John Paul II who came up with the idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. It was first a cross that was put in St. Peter's Basilica during the
Jubilee year.
Yeah, was it 1983, I think? Mm. And then at the end of the Jubilee year, John Paul II decided to give this cross to the youth of the world. And there's a beautiful inscription on the front, on the plaque, and it says that John Paul II has entrusted it to the youth of the world, that we carry it through the world as a sign of Christ's love for humanity. And I'm pretty sure John Paul II didn't imagine that we would carry it in this way, because it's literally been to every continent, it's been to hundreds of countries, and it's been carried by millions and millions of young people for 25 years. So it's significant just in that very fact. Yeah, it's pretty special.
It's also accompanied by an icon, isn't it? Now tell us a bit about that as well.
It's an icon of Mary and Jesus, and it's Salus Populi Romani, and it's actually a copy of a very old icon that's in St. Mary Major's Basilica in Rome. And this particular icon was given to the youth of the world in 2003 by Pope John Paul II, and he asked that it accompany the cross. So it really is a symbol of how Mary accompanied Jesus the right way through his life and was at the foot of the cross in his most trying moments. And it's also a sign for us to really remember that Mary accompanies us and our journey with Christ as well. And so it's just a beautiful icon. It's very big, and it's very heavy to carry as well. So it's amazing to just really sit and contemplate and to look at Mary's gaze. She's looking out at us. And the idea is that it really draws us into her son, who she's holding.
Thanks there to Annalise Wursthorn. Dominican Bishop Anthony Fisher is an auxiliary in the Diocese of Sydney, and as the youngest Australian church leader, he was charged with coordinating World Youth Day 2008. He told me more about the lasting legacy of that event to the church in Australia.
When you talk to people in government, to the police and the various emergency services, to people in the other churches, to community groups like the Aboriginal elders and so on, group after group will tell you how very impressed they were with the Pope, but especially with the young people. That Sydney came alive with a joyfulness that it really has never experienced before. And Sydney is, in many ways, a party city. It's used to big events. It's used to having lots of fun a lot of the time. But never before had people experienced an invasion of faith and idealism and joy on the face of those young people as they saw. And one after another of these government officials and police leaders and firemen and so on have said to us, we just wished it would never end. They were a bit frightened in the lead-up to it, the sheer scale and complexity, but when it actually happened, those young people, I think, softened even the hardest hearts. And that, I think, is an enduring legacy for the church, because it's affected people's impressions of the church. I think many people, particularly those who are not often at church, saw it as essentially old-fashioned, for old people, and they were astonished to see so many normal, happy, lovely young people there at World Youth Day, very proud of their faith, very active in their faith. And that's changed, I think, the general impression that the people in Sydney in government and secular society had of the church.
It certainly was something quite extraordinary for what is a very secular, perhaps quite cynical, very materialistic society.
We had a very hostile media in the lead up to World Youth Day, using it as an opportunity to bash up the church in various ways. And it was fascinating to see the change once the young people arrived. It was quite infectious, and reporters who would often be pretty hard, cynical about the church and about perhaps many institutions, loved World Youth Day and said to us they were completely captivated by it themselves. And I think that's true probably for many people who would have been at least suspicious of World Youth Day, and some of them outright cynical about it, that they were, when it actually happened, very impressed. And above all, they loved the Pope and the bishops and others who visited, but above all by the young people themselves. When people think of big crowds of young people, I think many people think of football crowds or crowds at concerts. They think drugs, they think violence, they think there's destruction of property, old people, lock yourselves inside, don't dare go out. And for this magical week or 10 days in Sydney, everyone wanted to be on the streets with those young people. It lifted everyone's spirits.
It must be quite difficult for you coming down from that high, isn't it, and carrying on with normal life?
Yes, and certainly as I look forward this week to handing over the World Youth Day Cross to the Madrid team, I remember back to 3 years ago when we were here to receive it from the Germans, from the young people of Cologne, at this same Mass in St Peter's Square on Palm Sunday. The young Germans were all crying, and young Australians were, of course, very excited and proud. And I wonder how many of us are going to be crying in our turn this Sunday. It was a wonderful time for us, and it's in some ways hard to let go of, even though I think we're all very proud of what was achieved, and we're pretty exhausted by the end of it, so we're happy to be passing it on to someone else to do next time. But this was, I think, the high point for the church in Australia in its history so far, in its 200 or so years, and it's something that this generation of young people will treasure for the rest of their lives.
Thanks there to Auxiliary Bishop Anthony Fisher of Sydney. And that's all from us here at the English programme for today. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.